The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Pippa Carrera.
The Home Secretary apologised to the House of Commons yesterday for any anxiety caused, and I want to apologise to you today.
A generation of Commonwealth citizens were invited to rebuild post-war Britain. Now they're being told to produce their paperwork or risk deportation. Some have been denied re-entry to Britain after holidays, others even denied medical treatment.
This is a day of national shame, and it has come about because of a hostile environment policy that was begun under her Prime Minister.
How could this happen? How can it be fixed? And at what political cost to the government? We'll hear from the Guardian journalist who broke the story, a former Lib Dem government minister who raised the alarm while Theresa May was still Home Secretary, and our panel of experts. Also this week, after an avalanche of recent allegations of sexual harassment in politics, has anything really changed? We investigate how the Scottish Parliament is dealing with the issue. But first, back in 2012, Theresa May stated that her Home Office would create a hostile environment for undocumented migrants. It was the latest way in which she could try to meet the government's target of cutting net immigration by nearly a third to below 100,000. Now the consequences of that decision are starting to bite, and the so-called Windrush generation of British citizens are having their status questioned. The case of Albert Thompson has been particularly distressing.
I've been living in the UK for the past four, five years. I went to my GP for a checkup, blood test taken. So when I go back to my GP for the result, prostate cancer. I thought they were going to take me in and start the treatment at the Royal Marsden. One of the nurses, she not even take me into a room, just in the walkway. And she was talking to me and she says, if I cannot produce passport or visa, then I have to pay. First of all, she says £53,000. And then she says £54,000. I don't know, I feel like I was going to pass out really. Because I said, you know, 54 tons per pound, I don't have it, not even 54 pence. You know, so there you go. That's why they stopped the treatment.
Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. First of all, I want to make one point very clear, that no urgent treatment should be withheld by the NHS, regardless of ability or willingness to pay. No? I also want to make clear that, as it happens, Mr. Thompson is not part of the Windrush generation that I have just spoken about in answer to the first question. And finally, clinicians have been looking at Mr. Thompson's case, and he will be receiving the treatment he needs.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, I'm joined now by my panel. On the line, we have Colin Yeo, an immigration lawyer. Here in the studio, The Observer's Sonia Soda and a reporter who broke this story, Amelia Gentleman. Amelia, tell us how we got to this point and why the government seems to have been so complacent about it until this week.
So I've been looking at this issue since last November when I went to Wolverhampton to meet a woman called Paulette Wilson, who had at that point just been freed after a week in Yarlswood, which is the notorious detention centre for women. Paulette is 61 and she moved to the UK in 1968 when she was 10 and she's never left the country. She's never applied for a British passport and she has no papers. So a couple of years ago, she found herself categorised as an illegal immigrant. It's worth saying that she has never been in trouble with the law. She's paid taxes for 40 years. They've got 34 years of national and insurance records. And she even spent some time working in the House of Commons serving food to MPs. She told me about how she'd spent this time in detention. She was absolutely devastated and she couldn't understand why it had happened. We wrote about her. The Home Office was quite anxious to look into her case, but they also said the fault was hers. She hadn't made the right application. She hadn't sent the right documents in. She still hasn't had an apology, although her case has been resolved, and she's had no compensation. But after we wrote about her case, more and more cases started coming to us slowly. Other people who'd been in detention, people who'd been made homeless because the local authority didn't recognise that they had eligibility for housing, people who'd lost their jobs because their employers had asked them for proof of eligibility to be in the UK and had said, well, you don't have a passport, so we can't continue to employ you. And these are people who, on the whole, have been in the UK for about half a century, totally considered themselves to be British. In fact, are British, are here legally because they came before the 1973 Immigration Act came into force. So in no way can be classified as illegal immigrants. But somehow, because of the aftermath of Theresa May's hostile environment, found themselves in this horrible situation. What was quite interesting reporting about it was that there was really not very much response. The Home Office was a bit defensive in the way that it dealt with the cases. It did try and help with the individual cases that we highlighted, and it was a bit sobering, I suppose, to see the speed with which individual cases got suddenly resolved after the people's photographs were in The Guardian. But there was no political reaction from the government. And when we wrote about Albert Thompson, his was the first case that did get discussed in PMQs about a month ago. Mm-hmm. And Theresa May promised to look into it. And when she had looked into it, she wrote to Jeremy Corbyn to say, well, actually, he needs to provide us with the evidence that he is here legally. And this was a man who's been in the UK for 44 years. He'd worked and paid his taxes and who had been working right up until the moment that he got ill. And who was made homeless and then was refused cancer treatment on the NHS. So her response to that really, really upsetting case was extremely hardline. So it's been amazing mm-hmm. how quickly that's turned around in the last week. Largely, I think, as a result of the sudden arrival of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in London.
That's put particular pressure on the Prime Minister, presumably, because these cases have been raised by those very same heads of government, and it's turned into a bit of a diplomatic nightmare for her, hasn't it?
Well, there was a very, very peculiar refusal by Downing Street to organise a meeting on this issue that was requested formally by the 12 High Commissioners of the Caribbean Nations. They had a rejection from Downing Street, who said Theresa May didn't have time to meet with them and it didn't go on the official schedule. They were very, very distressed, said it was most unfortunate. And at that point, when we wrote about that rejection in The Guardian on Sunday, that, I think, is when the whole scandal began to really get people's attention.
You mentioned the specific case of Albert Thompson, and obviously we've just heard Theresa May responding to some of the questions about the case that you raised. She said clinicians were dealing with his case, but that was news to him, wasn't it?
Well, all the way along, he's been treated so badly, and the treatment that he received yesterday when he was used as a political trump card by Theresa May was actually particularly bad. So since November, he has had no contact with his cancer specialist at the Royal Marsden Hospital, apart from one very brief phone call. He got a phone call, I think, about a month ago after The Guardian put a video of him online. We'd been contacting the hospital saying, why aren't you in touch with Albert Thompson? And he suddenly, out of the blue, got a call from his clinician who said to him, Mr. Thompson, that's actually not his real name, you look very well on the video. And that was really all it was. So yesterday he heard from his caseworker who'd heard on the telly that he was going to get treatment, but he spent the whole day wondering, was he going to get treatment? When was it going to come? And it was only at about 5 or 6 o'clock that he actually got a phone call from somebody at the hospital, I'm not sure who, and all he has at the moment, unless something has changed today, is an appointment to have his bloods done in 2 or 3 weeks' time.
Sonia, the Home Secretary and the Prime Minister have been thoroughly embarrassed by this. How much pressure do you think they're under?
I think they're under a lot of pressure, and I think even more so today because we've seen the former head of the civil service come out, incredibly high profile, a man called Bob Kerslake, and he said that some ministers at the time thought that these hostile environment policies, you know, were reminiscent of the sorts of things that you might see in Nazi Germany, which is incredibly strong language. And I think over the last week, what we've seen is lots of people who've been associated with the Home Office trying to distance themselves from this. So the Home Secretary herself, Amber Rudd, said quite incredibly, I thought, she tried to distance herself from the policies of her own officials. We've had, you know, Liberal Democrat special advisers writing today about how worried the Lib Dems were about this when they were in government. And I think there's no getting away from the fact that this was a personal policy of Theresa May. She was Home Secretary when the hostile environment was introduced. It was very much one of her sort of personal signature policies there. And I think there's no getting away from it as Prime Minister that the buck really has to stop with her. And I think, you know, I don't think that it will be seen as a resigning matter necessarily, but I think it absolutely should be.
So a blow to her reputation, but you don't think that it'll actually go any further?
I think she will probably end up weathering this, and that will be about the politics in her own party and the fact that, you know, people don't want to rock the boat in her party at this sensitive time just before Brexit. But I think substantively, I mean, if we take a step back from this, this is, you know, these are really shocking, I think, occurrences. You've seen a campaign that unites, you know, papers like The Guardian, immigration and refugee charities, also the Daily Mail and The Telegraph. So there's a real consensus that these policies are shocking and need to stop. And I think in other circumstances, it might actually be seen as a resigning matter for a prime minister.
And what about Amber Rudd? How much of it is sticking to her? I mean, the Home Office has gained a reputation as a graveyard for many a political career. Could it claim another victim here?
Potentially. I think what we've seen over the last week is people who are close to her briefing left, right and centre that this was really a Theresa May policy. I think there are questions for her to answer. You know, absolutely, she's working for a prime minister who was kind of whose centrepiece of her policy essentially was this. But at the same time, I do think if you're a minister, you've got a responsibility to raise around the cabinet table if you've got very serious concerns about this policy, which it seems like Amber Rudd has. And I think, you know, we've seen sort of Jeremy Hunt say the same thing or imply the same thing about NHS spending, for example. I think actually cabinet ministers, you know, May is not a very strong prime minister. She is in hock to her party. She doesn't have a majority. So my question would be, why haven't we seen ministers holding, you know, if they don't agree with these policies, why haven't they used some of the power that they've got around the cabinet table? And I think this does contribute politically to a growing sense of a prime minister who, you know, once she's developed a policy and got it in her head, she really sticks with it. She's stubborn. She doesn't budge. I think politically, it's just shocking. When I saw the Albert Thompson case unfold, I was really shocked at her response to it 4 weeks ago, because even back then, people were saying this is absolutely not right. And she appears as though she has a tin ear, as if she's inflexible, she can't respond to changing events. And I think this case just absolutely adds to that sense.
Colin, you deal with the Home Office on a regular basis. How can the government not know whether they've deported some of these citizens?
That's a good question. They don't keep terribly good records, frankly. And one of the underlying problems here is that the people who are affected, they've never held papers, some of them. So the government doesn't know they're here. So inherently, if you don't know that somebody's here, it's hard to know whether you've actually removed them or forced them to leave or something of that nature. So it's quite hard to quantify, to be fair to the Home Office.
Can you give us a sense of what this hostile environment actually means in practice for those affected?
Well, I think the best way to describe it is as a sort of de facto ID card system. It's like having identity cards, but without the actual convenience of universal identity card that all citizens have. Instead, it's targeted only at migrants. And it's basically about fellow citizens conducting immigration checks on one another within the United Kingdom and asking for proof of status. It's kind of papers, please type checks, which is profoundly un-British, as I think a lot of people would think. But because this has been done to migrants only, there has been very little political resistance to it. When ID cards were being proposed by the previous Labour government, there was a great big campaign about that, and it was stopped in the end. And I think the incoming Conservative Liberal Democrat government in 2010 kind of abandoned those plans. But we've seen no kind of nobody's that bothered, basically, because it's immigrants that it's been done to. And the problem is that it's causing real discrimination on the ground. So now employers have had to check papers of employees for some time now, although the level of the fines that they face has been ramped up in recent years. So it's up to £20,000 for employing a single individual unlawful worker. But it's also been extended by Theresa May to landlords, to healthcare checks, to there's new marriage checks that take place supposedly to prevent sham marriages. So it happens in all walks of life now. And basically, there's a lot of research to suggest that if you are look or sound foreign, to put it one way, or to put it another way, if you've got, you know, if you're an ethnic minority or you're black, then you're more likely to be asked for papers, because that's how a lot of ordinary citizens sort of react to these kinds of laws.
And if I could just jump in there, I think that point that Connor makes is so important because it illustrates, you know, whenever she defends this policy, Theresa May says, well, we've got a hostile environment for people who are here illegally, but, you know, people who are here legally shouldn't be caught up in it. But people who are here legally cannot help but be caught up in it because we know from research that landlords, for example, it makes landlords less likely to want to rent to someone who doesn't have a British passport, who has a foreign sounding name, or who doesn't have white skin. So it cannot but affect British citizens who are here legally.
Back in 2013, the existence of a hostile environment working group in the Home Office was revealed to The Guardian by the Lib Dem ex-minister Sarah Tether. It was the first time the shift in emphasis at the Home Office had been formally recognised, and it's at the root of the story the government is now frantically trying to get to grips with. I called Sarah Tether earlier and asked her how she feels about it now, 5 years on.
Just deeply sad, really, that all the things that I was anxious about at that stage have come to play, and now in my current work, having left Parliament, I'm now working for a small refugee organisation working with asylum seekers, and we're seeing the consequence of that hostile environment every day borne out in people's lives.
When you were an MP, were you aware of this change of tone in the Home Office once this hostile environment working group had been set up?
I mean, my sense looking back at them, and I had to deal with the Home Office on a number of different occasions as an education minister, most notably because I was the Lib Dem who was responsible for negotiating the ending of the detention of children in the immigration system. So I had a lot to do with the Home Office during that phase. And, you know, I mean, the Home Office, there's a kind of atmosphere and tone and attitude to the external world that is seeped into the walls. I mean, it is about enforcement, and it always has been. But what changed really was that Theresa May was giving very clear direction that she wanted this level of hostility. And what I noticed, I'd say more than within the Home Office, it was a kind of change in political language and change in the way in which politicians were using the media, so that the space for making a different kind of argument, something which was more humane, that was more balanced, that space just closed down. And when I did the interview with The Guardian back in 2013, just before I made the decision to leave Parliament, it was out of this frustration, really, that there wasn't a space to make those arguments in public anymore, to become very, very difficult. And what I've noticed since is that space has got narrower and narrower. It's been even more difficult. So you know, this phase of highlighting the injustice done to those who came during the Windrush era is the first time for a while that I've seen a chink in that wall, and people have been able to look dispassionately at the consequences of the hostile environment and see what it really means for human lives, and say, well, hang on a minute, is this what we really want? Is this the country that we've become? And in a way that, although it's awful, it's also, maybe it's a hopeful moment, maybe people will finally reflect and change direction.
Former Lib Dem Minister Sarah Tether there. Amelia, where does this story go now?
I think we're all incredibly interested in what this means for the hostile environment policy. As Sonia said, the apology from Amber Rudd on Monday was quite extraordinary. She said she was sorry for the appalling actions of her own department. She said that officials had sometimes lost sight of the individual and had focused too much on policy and strategy. So clearly she was talking in the context of this very precise group of Windrush people. However, at The Guardian and in other media, we've been reporting for years the very, very cruel human fallout from the hostile environment. And in a way, the kind of logical conclusion from what Amber Rudd was saying in her apology on Monday was that she's uncomfortable with the impact of the hostile environment and how it's hurting people. So I think certainly we'll be looking at what happens next for the hostile environment. And is Amber Rudd less keen on it than Theresa May?
And Sonia, you mentioned the intervention, extraordinary intervention of Bob Kerslake last night, placing the blame squarely on ministers, not on officials.
And I think that's absolutely fair. It's ministers who set policy. Officials have to execute that policy. There is absolutely no question that this policy did not come from Theresa May, the Prime Minister, and that Theresa May should be held responsible for it. And I think, you know, although I think it probably is very unlikely to provoke her resignation as Prime Minister for some of the political reasons that we've just discussed, I do think there will be political ramifications for the Conservative Party. Theresa May was somebody who, you know, sort of 10 years ago or actually a bit longer as Conservative Party chairwoman said, you know, we've got to end this image of the Conservative Party as the nasty party. And it's always been a problem for the Conservative Party in the way that it appeals, for example, to ethnic minority voters. Now, David Cameron said, you know, that was really important to him, appealing to ethnic minority voters. And I think this is actually really going to get in the way of that. And that is going to become more politically significant for the Conservatives over the next 10 years as demographics change. So I think this only is not a terrible thing, you know, for our country, the way these people are being treated. I think there may well be ramifications for the Conservatives politically as well, and quite rightly too.
And Amelia, at the root of this is the lives of the people that have been affected. Do you think that the Home Office and Amber Rudd have done enough by announcing they're going to set up a task force? Is that going to get to grips with actually what's happening to them on the ground?
Well, I think logistically it ought to make things a little bit easier for this very, very precise niche group. But it's worth noting, as Theresa May did yesterday, that Albert Thompson, who's perhaps the most iconic of the people who've been caught up in this, doesn't actually come into that group for this very legalistic reason that he arrived in the UK on December of 1973, when the cutoff date to be in this group was the 1st of January. I think Amber Rudd's announcement doesn't go far enough. The people who I've interviewed over the past 6 months, probably 15 or so, the response that I've been getting from them over the last 48 hours has been that they're very angry. There haven't been any personal apologies. There's been no compensation for the fact that they've lost their homes, been wrongly detained, or lost their jobs.
And Colin, EU citizens will be looking at this and thinking, what if my right to remain is questioned in 30 years' time? Should I risk it?
Yeah, it's interesting to draw a parallel between what happened as sort of back in the early 70s and what's happening now to EU citizens. So in both cases, you've got a whole group of people who arrived lawfully and who had a right to be here. And that right was changed after they'd entered the country and started to build their lives here. Now, looking at the situation for EU citizens, they're in a similar situation. Most of them will be fine. They'll be making the applications that they have to make in order to obtain the new immigration status that's going to be available. They're calling settled status. But there's a real risk that there's a substantial chunk of people. It's a minority, but we're talking about so many people that it'll still be quite a lot of people who won't make the applications for one reason or another. There's a particular risk to children, for example, which is what we're seeing with the old cases, the Commonwealth citizen cases. Basically, parents didn't make applications they perhaps should have done or could have done at that time. And I think it's very likely that we're going to see decades down the line a lot of people who've been here for a long time who consider themselves to be British to all intents and purposes, other than a legal sense, but who find that they don't have a right to be here necessarily.
Well, you can continue to follow all our reporting on this story at theguardian.com. The sexual harassment scandal swept through politics last year, prompting investigations, resignations, and an outpouring of personal stories from women who faced years of abuse and unwanted attention from colleagues. And the Scottish Parliament at Holyrood was far from immune. Our correspondent Libby Brooks in Edinburgh has been trying to find out if anything is changing.
I'm in Holyrood, where MSPs have just returned after recess, and how the Parliament deals with sexual harassment is on the agenda.
Good evening. Mark MacDonald, the former Scottish Government Minister, has tonight been suspended by the SNP after what's described as new information came to light about his behaviour.
Holyrood saw quite extraordinary scenes just before recess began, prompted by the return to the Parliament of Mark MacDonald, the former childcare minister who resigned from the Scottish National Party after an investigation found him responsible for persistent and inappropriate behaviour towards women, but who refused to stand down from the Parliament. At one point, the Holyrood authorities had to bar members of the press pack from the building's basement where they were trying to photograph MacDonald's new office after he was turfed out of the MSP's block, while MacDonald himself gave a series of interviews in which he insisted it was morally justified for him to continue in post, despite the First Minister and SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon urging him to give his constituents the chance to reconsider.
Mark MacDonald, are you a sex pest?
No.
Well, what are you then? How would you define your own behaviour?
I'm a person who has made errors in the past in terms of how I've behaved towards people, where I've behaved in a manner that has fallen below the standards that I should have set for myself and that should have been expected of me.
But the story of sexual harassment in Holyrood is not only about this one case by any means. Just before MacDonald's fraught return, an anonymous survey found that one in five Holyrood staff and one in three women had experienced sexual harassment or sexist behaviour while working in the Scottish Parliament. Of those who reported experience of sexual harassment, 45% identified the perpetrator as an MSP. Danny Garavelli is lead columnist for Scotland on Sunday, and she's written extensively, and I think it's fair to say with increasing anger and frustration, about how sexual harassment has been dealt with by the Scottish Parliament.
Well, I think in terms of sexual harassment, there's a sense of disappointment that things haven't moved more quickly, particularly because Holyrood, when it was set up, the idea was it would have a different culture than Westminster. There was going to be family-friendly hours, there was going to be not a drinking culture. And what we found is through the survey is that the problem of sexual harassment appears to be exactly the same as it is in Westminster, and yet we seem to be moving more slowly than Westminster in terms of setting up complaints procedures, etc.
And one other point that I think you have made very brilliantly along the way is that there is, because we have had all of this focus on this one case, it actually changes the way that we're speaking about sexual harassment in politics up here, because there's been this sort of huge focus on this one protagonist rather than looking at the issue more broadly.
Yeah, I think that was one of my biggest frustrations, was that it became this exercise in claiming a scalp, which in itself is not wrong. I mean, I do think he should have resigned, but what it did was to completely distract from the bigger issues of male power dynamics and institutionalised sexism and what you do to change a culture, and made it all about, you know, this one man, his individual flaws and what should be done about it.
But women working behind the scenes in the Scottish Parliament are more hopeful. Kezia Dugdale is Scottish Labour's former leader. She was appointed to the corporate body, the group of MSPs that oversees the running of the Scottish Parliament, at the start of the year, after she led calls for gender balance on this crucial oversight body.
If I was a member of the public, or if I was another member of the Scottish Parliament who didn't have access to the type of information I do because I'm a member of the Scottish Parliamentary corporate body, I would think that really nothing's happened since this report has come out, because it's very difficult to see any tangible examples of things changing. What I can tell you, though, is that the work behind the scenes is immense. There's a huge commitment from the highest levels of officers in the Parliament and elected members like the presiding officer, who now recognise that there's a significant problem here in the Scottish Parliament and are putting the necessary resources behind addressing those problems with tangible solutions. That includes a working group, which is a mixture of parliamentary staff and politicians, that I think meets now on a fortnightly basis with a very established work programme of things that need to happen. Will it cure everything? No, because a lot of this is societal, it's cultural, it's about how people talk to each other, it's about generational gaps between MSPs around, you know, what's acceptable language. But I am utterly assured, and I see it firsthand, a real commitment from the Parliament to make sure we make significant progress, so we're never in a situation again where 30% of women in the Parliament have experienced some sort of form of sexist behaviour or sexual harassment. That's astounding.
Kezia, aside from the ongoing work you've already mentioned, are there any other practical ideas for change that you'd like to see?
So I think one real practical thing that we have to do is to create a system, find a system where anonymised reporting of sexist behaviour and sexual harassment can lead to actions. And I think one way of doing that is maybe with the trigger system. The idea would be that a woman could come forward and report that she's experienced some form of behaviour or harassment and ask that it's recorded and recorded anonymously on a record. What would then happen is that if, say, three or four, and I think the number is up for a debate, other instances come forward regarding the behaviour of that same person, most likely a man, then you would almost have a situation where you would have a class action response. You would have four or five women all alleging sexual harassment or sexist behaviour by man X, and then you can use their collective power to start a process to hold that man accountable for his actions.
As Doug Dale mentions, Holyrood's Standards Committee is conducting its own inquiry into the rules and regulations governing the reporting and investigation of sexual harassment complaints made against MSPs. The SNP's Kate Forbes is on the Standards Committee, and she's also one of a cohort of younger female MSPs elected for the first time at the Holyrood elections of 2016.
So I've said in the past that having worked in a bank, which you may think is a very male-dominated world, having come through university, politics was the first environment where I felt that people treated me differently as a woman. It's a very sort of public-facing job. People make come to an impression of you on the basis of what you look like, and that is, you know, particularly difficult when you are a young woman. And sometimes I think it's youth. Sometimes I think it's my gender. Sometimes I think it's a mixture of both. But people have unrivaled access to you in terms of social media, but also being able to visit you, coming to your surgeries. And that's good. We want our politics to be transparent and we want politicians to be accessible. But it does mean that people know a lot about you and they feel like they maybe know you better than they really do. And they feel like they can approach you and they are allowed, they have a right to do or say whatever they like because you are in this public role. And of course, as a politician who cares about votes too, you are not inclined to be rude to people or to ask them to leave perhaps as quickly as you would in any other job or in any other role.
There's been a lot of talk about the need for a culture change in Holyrood more broadly, and I wonder if you could just tell us what you feel the Scottish Government's doing to make this happen.
Well, the difficulty when it comes to, for example, an inquiry with the Standards Committee is that we boil it down to procedures. And at the end of the day, none of this would exist and we wouldn't even need procedures if there was a change in culture. Because if the expectation is that men and women treat each other with equity and fairness and justice, then there wouldn't be a problem. And that goes right to the heart of how you change culture. And it's very, very difficult. And that's why I think that a number of initiatives that the Scottish Government are supporting will do something to actually change the culture. So one of their initiatives at the moment is setting up an advisory group on women and girls. And that is looking at how we champion policies, how we flag up areas of inequality, and how you go about changing the culture. And there's also been the Act recently on implementing 50-50 sort of gender roles on public boards. And again, these things are often dismissed as tokenism. And yes, there might be an element in which they're symbolic, but it's going to be symbols that change the culture. Because if I work in an environment where I look at my seniors or my bosses or my employers, and half of them are women and half of them are men, then the hope is that that power imbalance is less. And I feel that people see me as my role rather than just as a woman.
Libby Brooks reporting there from the Scottish Parliament. Well, that's all we have time for now. My thanks to Sonia Soda, Amelia Gentleman, Colin Yeo, Sarah Tether and Libby Brooks. Follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Pippa Carrera. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.